Welcome to Canary in a Cornfield, a podcast from the Harkin Institute for Public Policy and Citizen Engagement, where we explore how the policies that shape our food and farming systems impact our health, our communities, and our future. As most of our listeners probably know, the Harkin Institute was founded upon the retirement of longtime public servant and Iowa legend Tom Harkin, in order to continue doing high-quality work on the policy issues that were important to him. Hello, and welcome to Season 2 of Canary in a Cornfield. One important addition that you'll see is that we're now going to be sharing our interviews on YouTube as well as on other platforms. I'm really proud of the first episode this season, as I think it is genuinely introducing new information to the debate about the connection between nitrates and cancer in the United States. I interview Professor Thor Haldorsson of the University of Iceland, who was the chair of a Denmark Ministry of the Environment scientific committee that evaluated the risks of nitrates in drinking water and concluded, based primarily on the risk of colorectal cancer, that the ideal standard of nitrate in drinking water should be a factor of 10 lower than the current EU standard, which is very similar to the EPA standard in the United States. He was also a member of the committee revising the 2022 Nordic Nutrition Recommendations and has been a member of the European Food Safety Authority Scientific Committee. Before I jump into the interview, I need to explain something important about the difference between EU and United States standards for nitrates. Both the EU and the US standards are measuring concentration of nitrates in the water, and that concentration is measured as a unit of mass divided by a unit of volume. So they are expressed as milligrams per liter. Now, for those of you looking on YouTube, I am going to show a diagram as I describe this. And for those listening to the audio, you're going to have to just imagine. But very importantly, the EU standard measures the mass of the entire nitrate molecule, whereas the US standard measures only the nitrogen portion of the molecule. And since the nitrate molecule contains one nitrogen molecule along with three oxygen molecules, the mass of only the nitrogen portion is substantially lower than the mass of the total molecule. So what that means is that there's a conversion factor of 4.43 between the reported levels of nitrate and the nitrate standard in the EU, as opposed to the reported levels of nitrate and the nitrate standards in the US. The US standard of nitrate in drinking water is 10 milligrams per liter of nitrate nitrogen, which is sometimes denoted as NO3-N. 4.43 equals a standard of 44.3 milligrams per liter of total nitrate mass. And 44.3 is relatively close to the EU standard for drinking water, which is 50 milligrams per liter of nitrate. The reported nitrate levels in the US need to be multiplied by 4.43 to get the EU equivalent, because the US is only measuring the mass of the nitrogen molecule in nitrate, while the EU is measuring the mass of the nitrogen plus three oxygens. The conclusion of the Denmark Ministry of the Environment report was that they recommended a value of 6 milligrams per liter nitrate as a drinking water standard, which would be approximately 1.35 milligrams per liter nitrate nitrogen in US terminology. So just like for the EU, this recommendation would suggest a limit that is almost a tenfold decrease of the current standard set by the EPA. Two other things I'll highlight in advance that stood out to me from the interview. First, as Professor Haldorsson explains, the evidence for a connection between nitrates and cancers goes beyond just correlation, because there has been a plausible explanation of the underlying biology of how nitrates can cause cancer after they are converted into other chemicals in the human body. And second, this report relied extensively on a study of nitrates by Schuliner that had some key advantages over other studies. Namely, it looked at a population of 1.7 million people and had high-quality data over a number of years about exact nitrate levels in certain areas. So I think a case could be made that the Schuliner studies offer an extremely important source of evidence, which is bolstered by other studies in the United States and elsewhere. Okay, so with all that preamble out of the way, let's jump into this interview about an extremely important report. And very excited today to be joined by Professor Thor Haldarsson from the University of Iceland, who was the chair of a committee for the Danish Ministry of the Environment that wrote a report that is very relevant for what we've been talking about on this podcast. Professor Haldarsson, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Before we get into the report, I was hoping you could say a little bit about your own background and what your areas of research are.
Yes, so basically my background is in chemistry and mathematics. My professional career, I took a PhD in public health after finishing those degrees. And since 2007, I've mostly been working within the area of nutritional and environmental epidemiology. And along that path, doing epidemiological studies both in Iceland and in Denmark, where I have an affiliation and a research position, I drifted into chemical risk assessment in 2015, when I was appointed as an expert to the scientific committee of the European Food Safety Authority, where I've been providing expertise in chemical risk assessment. I've done something similar for WHO and also for other international agencies and also domestic. The work that we're talking about here is completely independent of that.
That's a very impressive background, and I can see why they chose you to chair this commission. So we've been having some pretty serious nitrate problems where I am in the drinking water, and I was very interested in this report because it analyzed some of the risks that are present from nitrates in the drinking water, and I feel like we're overdue in the United States for reassessing that question. So could you tell me a little bit about the history of this report and how it came about?
The background is basically that famous Ministry of Environment and Gentleman Quality, Indirect Quality, they initiated this work in 2019, where they're building on both work from other international agencies, which had more or less concluded that with 15 milligrams of nitrate in drinking water, equivalent to 10 milligrams of nitrogen, was safe. There was emerging evidence at the time. One study from Denmark in particular, that seemed to suggest that there was a cancer risk associated with current drinking water standards. And they got the Danish Technical University, the National Food Institute, to do an assessment of those findings and where the state of the earth was at the time. And bearing in mind that, for example, other international agencies like DECWA had done their assessment, I don't remember, in 2010 or 11, and the European Food Safety Authority has addressed nitrate in general in food in 2016 or 17, if I remember correctly. There was some new evidence there in between, and they wanted an assessment. And they concluded, based on the 2019 report, that there were some indications with no major concerns, or the evidence was a little bit inconclusive. But few years later, I think in 2024, they again were asked by the ministry to do an assessment with more evidence accumulated. And they come to the conclusion that the health risk of nitrate in drinking water, current drinking water standards, may not be sufficiently protective. There may be a health risk, or the health risk could not be excluded. And to the degree that was taken somewhat seriously in the ministry, and they then wanted to get an independent expert group from outside Denmark, or with a mix of international and local experts, to assess whether the concerns raised in the 22 report were substantiated, and if so, whether there was a need to revise the current drinking water standards. And that is basically what our role of this expert group that delivered this report was, to basically follow up on previous work. So it was not completely independent. It was not in a vacuum that we were established. And in between, until we delivered our report, there was new studies coming out as well, and we had to assess those.
That reminds me of something important for listeners to know, is the difference between how nitrate is represented in regulation in Denmark and other parts of the EU compared to the United States. So my understanding is that, as you referenced already, the EU standard of 50 milligrams per liter is referring to measuring the mass of the nitrate molecule as part of the concentration. But in the US, we measure only the mass of the nitrogen portion of the nitrate molecule. And so actually there's a conversion factor between the US and the EU ways of presenting this. And so that's why, as you mentioned, the EU standard of 50 milligrams per liter nitrate is roughly similar to the US standard of 10 milligrams per liter of the nitrogen portion of the nitrate molecule.
And the drinking water standards, the current drinking water standards in most countries is based on the blue baby syndrome of methemoglobinemia, which is an acute toxic effect. And this has been a problem for a long time, how to address with chronic exposure to low levels of nitrate. So that's basically it. Nitrate is pretty complicated because the rodent models, which we usually rely on for chemical risk assessment, they are maybe less appropriate for human setting in this particular case. And that complicates matters enormously.
I thank you for that. That's helpful to understand that better. And you mentioned a couple of the other studies that had come out before you put your report together. And am I right in remembering that there was a study from Denmark that looked at 1.7 million people? It looked at risk assessment with cancer with a pretty huge population of people.
Yeah. So I think just going back to why this committee was formed, that usually when you work in other settings, you get a mandate from maybe, let's say, the European Commission or WHO or nation states want something to be assessed because there is new evidence coming in. And then that is done independently. And most of the time, a chemical risk assessment is, and then also in the US, is done pretty independently. In this particular case, there was a pre-war by a really good expert group locally in Denmark, which came to this conclusion. Having initiated this two times, you can say fairly that there was a certain will within the community, or let's say by the government, to act on this possible risk. And that environment is sometimes very different from where you get a request and you're asked to do something and you don't know whether it's political will or not, and you come to a certain conclusion and then people start to argue whether this is the right conclusion or not. And this was a pretty helpful environment to some extent, that you have two rounds of experts and then you have an independent group of experts looking at this. And the influential factor here and the elephant in the room when it comes to epidemiology is that you're always worried that the results that you're getting are confounded. And we look at history of chemical risk assessment, and where human epidemiology has played that role is usually post-market among chemical. We rely on rodent studies to test substances before we market them. And we sometimes do other species of toxin rapids, and we do a lot of tests. And then if it goes through, then that's fine. And we start to use it. And maybe 20, 30 years or 10 years later, you're testing something in a large population. Everybody is getting exposed and you get more information. For chemicals that we know that are, for example, carcinogenic like asbestos, it took many years to come to the conclusion that we had to withdraw this compound even though the signals were relatively strong, say in the smoke. And here we are in the situation we are talking about nitrate, which is chemically the rodent model and the humans are not the same. We have a lot of nitrates in vegetable. You can eat a lot of nitrate from vegetables without any major concern. It's my conclusion based on the evidence that I see. In parallel, water is different, but it doesn't contain any antioxidants. So it gives meaning to look at drinking water separately. In Denmark, for example, the trust in drinking water and drinking water standards are pretty robust. Vast majority of the population uses tap water. Use of bottled water is very low, while in other areas, people don't trust the drinking water. So looking at studies in different countries on nitrate drinking water, there is a huge amount of noise in the data, and you have to consider settings. You know, what was good with this Danish report, which was a registry-based study where they could link every individual based on their unique identification number, where they were living, link that to the drinking water that they had at the time, and link the two and calculate accumulated exposure over a long period and linking that to the health registry with almost complete information. That's more, in our opinion, accurate than doing nitrate concentration at one or two points in time. So that could explain some of the inconsistencies that we have in the literature. And that's one reason why this Danish study was taken, I wouldn't say at face value, but it prompted some concern because the biological mechanism by which nitrate could result in cancer is reasonably plausible. And this is maybe one reason why we have inconsistencies in the epidemiological literature, but because the biology is reasonably well-defined, there is a cause for concern. And then there is always the case for when is the evidence sufficient enough to take actions. And this is the cross that every risk assessor has to bear. So it's that bit. But we came to the conclusion based on the previous expert groups had concluded that the nitrate and drinking water in Denmark seem to pose a health risk. And to refute that, we would have to have a really good argument based on the evidence. When we assessed it, that was not the case, and we came to the conclusion their conclusion was substantiated, and there was actually more evidence coming out supporting that. So we ended up saying, despite the evidence maybe not being as consistent as we have for some other substances, there is definitely a health risk. And as a precautionary measure, based on that conclusion, we derived drinking water limit, which is factor 10 lower than the current one.
That is so fascinating, and I really appreciate you explaining that in depth. And that's something that I wondered about. It seems like there's the strength of correlations from different studies and evaluating how well the studies are done. And then there's whether there's a plausible biological explanation of what's happening. You looked at both of those things. And then another aspect that I'm really curious about is, even if you have all the data, you have to make some kind of judgment about what's an acceptable level of risk. And how do you come up with that level of, if it's a 1 in 1,000,000 chance of increasing your risk of cancer by 10%, or 1 in 100 chance of increasing your cancer by 10%, how do you decide where to draw the line of what's an acceptable level of risk?
Yeah, and maybe I would give a little bit of a long answer, but there are two issues, and I talk just generally now, not talking about this particular work, but I will come to that. And generally, when it comes to chemical risk, zero is always safe. Going for a zero value is always safe. And the reason why we do chemical risk assessment is that we have to live with chemicals, and chemicals make our life in many ways easier. And in terms of economics and everything, there's a lot of benefits with chemicals. And then at a certain stage, we need to regulate certain chemicals, and or even nutrients. You can overexpose yourself to nutrients, and that's not healthy. So we need to have a balance. And then the philosophy is to come up with a limit that largely eliminates risk to any appreciable degree, but at the same time, gives the flexibility that the chemical is used. And for example, in radiation, high T, with good data accumulating over the early part of the 20th century, we could say 100,000, 1 in 1,000,000, and calculated very accurately because the correlation between radiation and cancer was pretty well established. But for many other chemicals, we really don't have that resolution. And I think also the standards that we set are a little bit indirectly influenced by the public. So let's say that we tend to overeat, drink alcohol to extent, to smoke and do these recreational things that we know are not healthy, but it's our own choice. But when it comes to chemical, we always blame them. And we say, no, the government should take care of this. And so chemical standards, the public is generally really interested in it, and they think that chemicals are often play. In many cases, our lifestyle is a major issue. But these are all factors that filter into how we do things. But in general, I think we set a very low bar for chemical safety. The threshold is very high. We have, in most cases, health-based guidance value, which are far stronger than if we had the best data that we had. Let's say, for example, we are marketing a new chemical. We do a rodent study. We find the threshold when the chemical starts to maybe do harm in the animals, and we divide by an uncertainty factor of 100 to protect humans. It's probably overdoing it most of the time. But here, we are not in that position. So we need to come up with a level for nitrate in drinking water that we mean that represent no appreciable risk to human health. And in this case, based on human data, which is where we have one study where we try to model it, there are a few data points. We try to use confidence interval around some threshold where we see minimal increase in risk, and we use that to draw the line. And that's why we end up with these 6 milligrams absolute nitrate concentration per gram liter. Now, it is the best that we could do based on the data that we have according to international guidance document on how to do dose response modeling or toxicological data. It's fair to say that with more, and this happens regularly in risk assessment, when you have new data, new studies, better density, you revise these guidance values as information comes along, because there is no way of saying that this is the absolute true value, whatever. But based on the data that we had, this is the most reasonable estimate that we can come up with, which based on existing data would protect against colorectal cancer in this case. So I'm going all over the place, but I hope you get the big picture that this is based on the data that you have, and coming up with a value where you can say you're absolutely right or wrong is rarely possible, but you come up with a reasonable value that you believe is protective.
I can see what a huge challenge it is, but the approach you're taking makes complete sense to me. And it's great that you have so much human data to bolster the evidence in this particular case. I wanted to ask too, just for context, what does agriculture look like in Denmark? Is Denmark a pretty heavy agricultural state? Are there certain exports that are a big part of the system there? And is that relevant to why they were particularly interested in nitrates?
Yeah, as I understand it, it's pretty heavy agriculture, sort of long cycle date, you know, living there, if I remember correctly. But they have quite intensive agriculture. They have around 25 to 8 million slaughter pigs per year. And you can imagine the ratio between humans and animals because they export a lot of meat for the rest of the world. And so basically the agriculture is quite intensive in terms of fertilizer and animal manure. And that is one reason why certain areas when the soil is pretty poor, so has low content of clay, you have the transfer of nitrate to groundwater and also other chemicals used in agriculture. There was actually a report last week in Denmark where they were quite concerned about the concentrations of pesticide residues being detected. So it seems like with certain decades of intensive agriculture, or given the conditions in certain areas of the country and the intensity, that there are problems on the horizon. But having lived in Denmark for 10 years, I think the good thing about that society in terms of openness and dialogue is that it's on the table and it's being discussed. And when we do a risk assessment on this subject of aquatic, you're not thinking about economics or anything. And I think that's what is happening in Denmark at the moment.
I lived in the UK for a couple of years and I visited some of the Scandinavian countries and I was really impressed with how there was this more clear cut, like if there's a risk or if there are health benefits, then that just needs to be discussed. Whereas I feel like in the US, there's definitely this underlying pressure of not offending some of the companies.
But there is always a trade-off. There is a risk that you overdo it in terms of, let's say, your too strict. It's not a thing that is often talked about, but being too protective, zero is always safe. It's not necessarily for a societal purpose helpful. I welcome the discussion about whether our report is right, but future will tell. I have seen risk assessment being revised on many occasions, where you take the best decision that you have, and then it's up to the risk managers to follow through. And what we did in this report, we calculated the benefits of going for different volumes in terms of what it would mean. So I think that is mounting, but the openness of society usually helps in the future because then you can tackle it. And whether the responsibility is with society or companies, or you go through the legal system, which is often the case in the US, I think being able to tackle the problem a little bit further ahead. Because once the damage is done, for example, if you see what happened with the whatever timber, like PFAS, where we started to look at it when it was all over the globe and with relatively high concentrations, and that is far too late. So there is more information sharing, acknowledgement that there might be something going on. Certain production sites in the US would have been extremely helpful, I think, for every, not just the public, but also for the companies.
So tell me a little bit about how did you decide which kinds of experts you wanted to have included on the committee?
When I was conducted as a possible chair for this committee, the terms of reference were focused on looking at what has been done before. With the bulk of the work, and if you agree with that, then you have to derive a health-based guidance when you're based on dose response modeling. Experts in terms of dose response modeling were one of the areas that we looked at, experts both within Denmark and outside, and then mostly experts that had worked from the European Food Safety Authority, WHO, or expert groups in the US. We have one who's been very active on the PFAS issue in Ohio. And so then the modeling expertise, we had two doctors with medical background and others with an epidemiology. We had a mixture of Danish experts who had not worked on the previous report and then other international experts. So we tried to have a little bit of a broad group with fresh eyes who had done chemical risk assessment before, but some who had not been familiar with chemical risk assessment. So a multidisciplinary approach. And that was a luxury, and it was actually a quite good atmosphere, and the level of agreement we were quite concordant in our conclusions.
That's good. Always nice to have a team that works well together. So you touched on it already, but could you say a little bit more about the conclusions of the report and how they were reached? I know you mentioned that you looked at colorectal cancer, but maybe say a little bit more about the exact conclusion of the report.
Yeah, so basically what we reviewed, the evidence that we had. There was some research, I think it was NIH-funded research on birth defects and birth outcomes, and there were some suggestions on birth defects at like high concentrations, but given the nature of these data, we didn't think it was suitable for dynamic health-based guidance value, but there were some signals there for different types of cancers other than colorectal cancer. There were some suggestions here and there, but not very conclusive. And it's always a function of number of studies and study quality and so on. But there was this study, the Danish one, the large one, on colorectal cancer, and there were some suggestive indications from the US studies in the same direction, linking, taking what the concentration into what the US studies with the cancer is more problematic, given the nature of drinking water bottle, water filters, and self reports, and so on. But there were some supporting signals there. Now, the conclusion on ARIA, that even though nitrate assay is not carcinogenic, nitrite is converted to nitrite in salvia, and that is the problematic part. And if it reacts with nitrosoburic amines, which is basically an amacrobase, or certain amino acids, the new pro-carcinogenic substances that may very well explain why you get cancer, or whether the cancer in terms of the digestive tract is plausible in that sense. So basically, with our biological plausibility of the mechanism and this Danish study, which we believe is quite high quality, supported by other evidence, we consider that there is indeed a concern. And so we came to the conclusion that as a precautionary measure, it would be justifiable to derive this finding. And the language here, you have to read into it because it comes in the context that we had previous groups in Denmark had reached this conclusion that was political will to address the issue. And yes, it is justified as a precautionary approach to help other value. If you want to eliminate the risk that we see from these studies, that the value that we came up with would be the most logical one. And there was also a newer study from Denmark as well, which could actually take diet into consideration because it's not drinking water alone, it's also your diet shapes your overall risk. And it's, for example, it's the same with other risk factors, but for example, like your blood cholesterol, it depends on other factors as well, whether it becomes a problem or not, that nitrate is a little bit in the same direction. And their conclusion after looking into the dietary habits and so on is that, yes, nitrate in drinking water was associated with elevated risk, even when you took diet into consideration. And if you looked at dietary factors that may promote this chemical reaction, you could see stronger risk. So that was more or less what, in my mind, but at least tested the balance and justified deriving a value which would then be protected. Now, having said that, like I said before, if we had better data, if we had different data and worse studies, we may have come up with a different value. It would be higher, it could be slightly lower. And this is from a societal point of view, it really matters because for the industry, it matters if you have a higher, and it also matters for the general public. So this is an open question, and I think this will be looked at in the future. But the justification is precautionary approach, and that's what we asked to do, and that's what we hope it came.
It makes a lot of sense, and we've been talking a fair amount about the precautionary approach here as well, or at least some people have been talking about it. I don't know if our government has, but I'm curious, the Danish Ministry of the Environment issued this report. What happens next then in Denmark? Are the regulations going to be debated in government, or are they going to be enacted? What's the process for after the report comes out?
Based on the news that I read, we do this independently and we're not interfering with what they're doing, is that they commission immediately mapping all drinking water suppliers in Denmark who would be compliant and non-compliant with such a value. And I think the assessment that I saw was approximately 10% of the water suppliers would have to make amendments. That means, I don't know the process immediately. I think it's diluting the water then from other sources to get below that value. I would think that is manageable. So I think this is not going to be in isolation. I think there will be a general strategy around drinking water. I think they have been very proud of their drinking water and the fact that they use tap water as drinking water. And this is what they would like to retain. So that means some action. And I think it's better to take that sooner rather than later, because inevitably with more intensity and longer duration of intense agriculture, you will reach a different stage. So that is where they are now. There has not been a legislation or anything, but immediately they start to map things to look at what can be done. That's where it is at the moment. But I think the signal to society has been quite strong in the use.
That's good to hear. So how do you see this report relating to other countries and other institutions? Do you think the findings here are relevant for other countries in the EU, for the US? Do you think this is something that the EU might take up to reevaluate their standard?
Generally speaking, usually these reports have some influence. I would say. They initiate in other countries than Denmark who are proactive in having different standards for BPA, bisphenol A. What could happen is that there will be other expert committees looking at this report and either refuting it or confirming. Now, when you have a report, there is a certain overhead in refuting it. You have to have good arguments, and if they can be made, that may happen. It may also happen that people come to an intermediate decision, or they may actually go the full way and say that we agree with this conclusion, but there could be increased amount of funds into nitrate-related research. That could be one option. So there are various things, but usually I would say reports like this have some real emotions. And we look at reports from the US and we think they are relevant in all the parts of the world when it addresses an issue that may be potentially relevant to suburbs. And I don't see any reason why it shouldn't be in the US. But I want to be balanced and say it's important to look at this in a regional perspective and have an expert group going up to the decision.
Yeah, that makes sense. How you consider EPA's conclusions, and it's been quite a while since the EPA looked at nitrates or at least released any guidance on it. And as you already mentioned, it's based more on blue baby syndrome than any kind of risk of cancer. But if the EPA issues some guidance, you would look at it with a critical lens as something that could be valuable.
We, in Europe, we look at the reports coming from the US EPA, Agency for Toxic Substances, FDA, very high standard, extremely capable experts, and they have set the stage for chemical safety for decades. And Europe has done a really good job, I think, as well. And there has been quite a lot of focus on the issue. And I think on both sides of the Atlantic, we have quite good standards. At the end of the day, there is always a political environment, not we as experts, and I think the same in the U.S., even looking at the U.S. dietary guidance for Americans, the science there is quite good. Some of the interpretation you can, yes, well, let's leave that aside. But I think we as expert groups usually work quite independently. But there is an element, not necessarily politics, but there is the mandate has a background. And I think whether you get the mandate or not, or whether people are interested in look at something, there is a little bit of societal and political logic behind that. And I think that's fair, because we as experts should not work in a political way. We have to stick to the science. But I think whether this report would have any influence in the current situation in the US or not, I wouldn't be able to say. But that element is definitely there. And also the public can have quite a lot of influence. The other issue is we try to estimate the proportion of population, the number of cases that could be reduced if concentrations will be reduced. So when we talk about the relevance to, let's say, the US or other regions, I think it comes down to the risk factors that you want to have control and take action towards. It's clear dietary habits have enormous influence on your colorectal cancer risk, smoking, and alcohol. And these are all individually manageable. We have problems in terms of dietary guidelines and getting people to adhere to them. But in case that it is possible to reduce nitrate, thinking about the nitrate concentrations, this would be one risk factor that could be at least reduced. And since it's possible in Denmark to monitor it, whether improvements could be seen in the future if they go along and reduce the levels, could be used as one line of evidence to review to support what we actually suggest. So I think risk assessment, the chemical risk assessment, is a moving target. You do what you have with the evidence, the time, and we usually, for many chemicals, we revise them regularly. And this is how I would like to see the report interpreted. I think sometimes waiting until you have overwhelming evidence, then you wasted maybe 20 years of doing something. But there is balance. So this is something that we are continuously trying to improve and get international recognition of how to do things.
Thank you so much, Professor Halderson. This has been incredibly informative. I think it's really important for what's happening in the state of Iowa. And actually, there was a report in the Washington Post that showed that leading corn-producing states in the United States all had increased cancer risks in people under the age of 45. So it might even have broader implications than where I am. But I think you did a really wonderful job, and it's very important work. So I appreciate you taking the time to explain it to us.
It's really nice to be able to explain this. So thank you very much.
That's it for this week's episode of Canary in a Cornfield. Just a reminder, you can find us on social media, which includes X, Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok, and find our webpage at parkininstitute@drake.edu. And this podcast is also hosted by Substack Canary in a Cornfield, which will include some additional links and resources that go beyond just what's in the episode. So thank you all for tuning in, and I will be talking with you soon.